I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Carmen Aguirre joins me again. She was last on 5 years ago when her best-selling and critically acclaimed book, Something Fierce, Memoirs of a Revolutionary Daughter, was released. She's just published a follow-up, Mexican Hooker Number 1 and My Other Role Since the Revolution. It's such a compelling read. I'll get Ms. Aguirre to tell us about this book, about what's happened in her life from where Something Fierce ended and where this book picks up from. At the age of 6, Carmen was a Chilean refugee arriving in North America. At 18, she was a revolutionary dissident married to a man she couldn't really love. We see Carmen as she goes to theater school here at Studio 58 in Vancouver, where she's forced to confront the assault she suffered at 13 years old at the hands of the so-called paper bag rapist. And years later, we see Carmen face the man who raped her. This book has a lot of unforgettable moments. It's often funny as well. We'll explore a few of the themes in the book. Carmen Aguirre lives here in Vancouver, where she's had a noted career as a theater artist and playwright. Her plays include The Trigger, The Refugee Hotel, and Blue Box. This new book is published by Random House. It will be launched here in Vancouver on the 2nd of May at Cottage Bistro, 4470 Main Street. There's also an appearance with the Writers' Fest's Insight series at the Central Branch of the Vancouver Public Library on the 4th of May. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, Carmen Aguirre. Ms. Aguirre, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I talked to you when Something Fierce came out, and so, to sort of for people listening to us to put this new book, Mexican Hooker Number 1, in perspective, what are the years that you cover in this new book?
This new book kind of covers, it's interesting because it picks up where Something Fierce left off, but it does flash back all the way to the early 70s before the coup in Chile, and then flashes and then covers territory all the way until 2014. So, yeah, it covers about 40 years, I guess.
Yeah, and after Something Fierce came out, did you want to write another book, say, to follow up what you'd written about before?
Yes, I knew that I wanted to write a second memoir, and it became clear to me when I was touring Something Fierce, just in terms of the questions that were being asked by audience members and readers and journalists, that, you know, everybody wanted to know how one heals from living in a state of chronic terror, which is what I described in Something Fierce when I was in the Chilean resistance. And then also, how does one find meaning in one's life after living a life so full of meaning when one is a youth? So those were the two kind of questions that I wanted to zero in on in writing the second book.
Yeah, and I guess, when I read Something Fierce, I wanted to know what happened after that. It's a marvelous companion to the first book in terms of, say, following where you went from where Something Fierce ended.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted this book. The theme is healing from PTSD. That's the umbrella theme. So all the stories that I chose to tell in this one fell under that umbrella. And in telling the story of healing from PTSD in regards to living in a state of chronic terror, it became apparent that I also had to tell the story of healing from PTSD in regards to the rape that I suffered at the hands of a paper bag rapist when I was 13 years old here in Vancouver.
One assumes that when you write about something like that in a book like this, that you've had to do the healing before you started writing it. I mean, I would assume that you did. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. I'm a big believer that if you're writing for personal catharsis, that's journaling. That's not writing for, professional writing for public consumption. So, yeah, I had healed from all those experiences before I wrote about them. And for me, it's more about universal experience as opposed to personal catharsis.
Yeah, and so I'm wondering what you would like the reader to get out of this. I mean, other than, say, reading sometimes funny things in this book. I mean, the lessons there in terms of how you confronted assault, how you healed from it, and then one part in the book, you confront the rapist himself.
Yeah. I mean, when I write, I don't think about what I want the reader to get from it. I would consider myself kind of arrogant, I suppose, if I thought I had some kind of words of wisdom for the reader to walk away with. I just hope that they are entertained by the story, and if they can get something out of it, that's a plus.
Yeah, the one thing that struck me in reading the book is just the grace, the strength, the determination that you have conducted yourself with over the years, these various traumas that you've suffered. When people ask where that comes from, that strength, where do you point them to? I mean, what's the I guess, where does that come from, if you will?
Well, I mean, I don't forget whose daughter I am and whose granddaughter I am. So I come from a line of very strong people from Chile. I consider Chileans in general to be very, very strong people. And I don't forget that. In terms of being raised here in Vancouver in the 70s by the Chilean refugee community, which at that time was one of the poorest demographics in the city because we arrived with nothing, I learned a great deal about strength from those people who raised me, like my parents, of course, but also the rest of the Chilean refugee community. People who were coming directly from concentration camps, who had been severely tortured and who did not have the luxury to just, lie down and sob. They had to get to work. So those were real role models for me about continuing your life and not letting those who have, oppressed you to beat you down.
Yeah, and after you were raped, you carried on. And you did your paper route. You went to school the next day. The idea that carrying on is an act of resistance, I mean, that's something that I got out of the book.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you got that out of the book.
I mean, you do feel the value in that, but I mean, you also see how that can also confront you later on, and I guess open up new wounds, if you will?
Yes, I believe that the longer you push things down, the more intense the healing will be, if you may. Your body, your soul, your psyche will eventually let you know that whatever trauma you've been carrying with you has to be dealt with.
Yeah. We've read about, even before we've picked up the book, we've read the excerpts of your book that have been published elsewhere in terms of you confronting the rapist. So some people who read that I talked to say, well, why would she bother doing that? And I guess you have to read the book to find out really why that was necessary for you. Again, I have to go back to this idea of just where who you are in terms of where this compassion comes from. I mean, how do you explain this seeming lack of anger and bitterness
towards the rapist, you mean?
Yeah, or just people in general who've done you wrong, if you will.
Because you could
easily, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I mean, I guess I did mean to interrupt you. But in the course of the book, I mean, you have had a lot of difficult moments, and for a lot of people, it would be easy to whine, say. But you don't do that.
No, I don't identify as a victim. And for me, I mean, being angry or full of hatred is really, it's not worth it for certain people. And they don't care if you hate them or are angry at them. You're just, those emotions are just chewing you up inside. They're not doing anything to them. And in terms of the compassion, it's not about, if we talk about the rapist, for example, it's not about letting him off the hook or believing he should be out of jail or thinking it's okay that he did what he did. It's more, it has nothing to do with him, as a matter of fact, than everything to do with me. And I believe that if you are compassionate, you are a happy person. So in the end, it's really about my own happiness and nothing to do with him at all.
So this time of year, we're talking on the 20th of April, this is around the time when that happened, is that right?
Yes, it happened on April 26, 1981.
Yeah, so this time of, I mean, you told Marsha Lederman in the Globe and Mail that this time of year would evoke memories and trauma within you still today, or has that changed, if you will? I mean, it doesn't go away, does it?
Yeah, no, it never fully goes away. I think you just learn how to integrate that kind of trauma when it's happened to you as a child. And it was a day kind of exactly like today, like a beautiful, hot, sunny spring day. I haven't felt it this April, although in March, in late March, when we did get the first warm couple of days that were sunny and, you know, yeah, spring was in the air, I felt a wave of old, very, very old sadness. And I know what it's about now, and I don't have to freak out thinking, oh my God, it's going to grip me and it won't let go, and I'll be sad for a long time. I know how to breathe my way through it now and know that it will pass, and it passes within a couple of breaths at this point.
The practice of being an actor, learning your craft as you have, I mean, that's obviously contributed to your understanding of your life. While you were, I guess, studying, it was at Studio 58 that the trauma of the rape came back, right? One wonders, in reading the book, how do you to get that understanding of one's life? I mean, did you have to go into acting, and how have others done it, say, who aren't actors like yourself?
Well, I mean, first of all, I knew that I wanted to be an actress since I was the age of 3, so I was going to do that, you know, whether I had a bunch of traumas or not. And it was thanks to going to theater school that I started a decade-long therapy session, as it were, to deal with all those traumas. And so basically, very early on in theater school, my mentors told me that it was obvious to them that I had PTSD and that I needed to get therapy if I was going to get through the program, which is why I started to do therapy. Now, in terms of the Chilean community, for example, I know a lot of Chileans who are now, you know, my age and older, who are dealing with lots of health issues, not necessarily mental health issues, but actual, you know, like cancer, for example. Mm-hmm. And they are people who have very, very, very severe trauma from the days of the coup, from being in concentration camps, from being tortured, who have never dealt with it. And they themselves have said to me, so this is not me, you know, doing some kind of pop psychology analysis of them. They have said to me that they believe that the reason why they are so ill now in their lives is because they didn't deal with those big traumas that happened to them when they were very young. So I just consider myself very lucky to have gone to a theater school where I was told that I had to get therapy, because I don't know that I would have otherwise.
Yeah. The other thing in the book, because you were in Vancouver in the late 70s, early 80s, you get a sense of what this place was like in those years. And you know, it's even a reader in 2016 recognizes the Vancouver. But there are differences, aren't there?
Oh, yes. Huge differences.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the big differences that doesn't get talked about a lot, it's certainly not in the mainstream, is that when we arrived in Vancouver in 1974, and through the 70s and early 80s, this really was a labor town. You know, it was the labor movement in Vancouver was huge, and those are the people who welcomed us, and those are the people who, you know, for me, that's what Canada meant. Canada was the labor movement, you know, the people, the working class Canadian who was in a union, who, you know, fought for, you know, workers' rights and came and welcomed the Chilean refugees and took us under their wing. So that's what Vancouver was at that time. I don't know if you remember, I don't know how old you are, but, you know, there was the solidarity movement in B.C. in the early 80s. And it wasn't until 1986 with Expo that it started to change.
Yeah, it's almost nostalgic or so sentimental, if you will, in reading about Vancouver in your book. And as I said, I'm 34, but I mean it's still recognizable to me. And you know, I recognize as well just how it's changed a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've got to let you go. I guess the other question that I had in the course of reading the book that I really wondered about was, because you've endured a lot, do people ask you if there's still the stuff in your life that phases you?
I guess people ask me. I mean, I would say that not a lot, you know, phases me, but I don't, I'm not interested, for example, I mean, this might be a silly example, but I'm not interested, for example, in watching violent movies or, yeah, being exposed to anything like that because it does affect me very deeply.
Yeah. I ran into you one time. Well, you came on the show, I guess, when Something Fierce came out, and I saw you on Commercial Drive maybe 3 or 4 months ago, and I wanted to say hello, but I was doing something and you were doing something, so I didn't come up to say hello. But if I did, I would have wanted to tell you just how much I admire your work over the years, and especially after reading this book, I can't tell you just what you drew out of me as a reader in terms of how I think about things, and I know it's a silly way of putting it, but it's such a good book that way.
Thank you so much. That means so much to me. Thank you.
And if I ever see you on the drive, I'll come up and say hello for sure.
Please do. I would love that.
Thank you, Carmen, for this and for writing this book. All the best.
Thank you.
The book is called Mexican Hooker Number 1 in My Other Roles Since the Revolution. It's published by Random House. Its author, Carmen Aguirre, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.